Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Royal Oak, Michigan, and earned a BA in Social Sciences from Central Michigan University and a law degree from Wayne State University. After serving in the Army, he joined Chrysler and then was an assistant U.S. attorney. From 1982 through 2007, he was a circuit judge in the Oakland County 6th Circuit Court. His name? The Honorable Judge Fred Mester. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
All rise. Court's now in session. The Honorable Judge Fred Mester presiding.
I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to the legendary Judge Fred Mester. Judge, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. I've listened to your program over the years, and I'm very impressed with the prior guests you've had, and I'm quite honored to be here tonight.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Sure. I grew up in Royal Oak, Michigan. I spent a lot of summers up in Shepherd, Michigan on my mother's father's farm, 30 acres. He was superintendent of the poor there. He only had 30 acres, and that's what he lived off of. I went through all the Royal Oak schools. I played baseball. In the fifth grade, they had you go around with a little list to sign up ball players. And at the bottom of the list, they showed captain. So I thought, as captain, I have the right to choose whoever can play any position. And the most critical position was pitcher. So even though I knew that a David Distant and a Jerry McDonald were better pitchers than me, I felt that I'm number one as a captain. So I go out there in the field the first game and walk the first seven batters. I hear little rumblings in the background, and they're talking about the fact my family will never see me again. I realized right then that I had to back off and recognize that I'm somewhat limited in my baseball attributes, and we ultimately won our championship in Royal Oak and went on to win in Hazel Park as fifth graders. And I played a little football at Royal Oak High School. Herb DeRomedy, who ultimately became the great coach up at Central Michigan University, he was a sophomore and a little superior to me, but we had a great team and we have been longtime friends.
Judge, what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
Well, I think the biggest thing I learned from both of them, that you are part of a community, and where people are hurting within that community, you make yourself available to assist them however you may. My mother was a school teacher, and my father came out of World War I out of the Navy and went on to become a tool and die worker here in Detroit, supporting his family back in Springfield of six children. He gave up the thought of going to college because he had a responsibility to his family. So caring for others, and particularly caring for family, is number one.
Speaking of legendary people in the world of sports, when you were at Central Michigan University, a young fellow student named Dick Enberg told you to do something.
Dick Enberg was a hero on Central's campus. He broadcast all the athletic contests, most particularly football. Came from Armada. He indicated the first time he ever used an inside toilet was when he went to Central Michigan University. But he was quite active in student government. He was student body president. He called me down to the sheds that had been built for World War II and Korean veterans with the GI Bill. And he talked to me about whether or not I'd be interested in student government. Well, I'd been in the dorm council of my dormitory, and I thought about it, and he encouraged me to get into student government, and I ultimately followed him as student body president of Central Michigan University. And we've been friends. We were at the centennial celebration of Central some 30 years ago when he gave a speech, and we're quite honored to have him as a graduate of that university.
And in the immortal words of Dick Enberg, oh my, the rest is history. After spending 2 years at Chrysler Realty, you joined the U.S. Attorney's Office for 7 years. Talk about that segment of your life.
Well, I was honored to serve with some outstanding attorneys, most particularly our two U.S. attorneys under which I served, Jim Prickley, who ultimately became a lieutenant governor of the state of Michigan, and Ralph B. Guy, Jr., ultimately became a U.S. District Judge and then a Court of Appeals judge. Harold Hood became a Court of Appeals judge and probably one of the most appointed judges in the state of Michigan simply because he's just simply a good man and a good judge. I learned a lot from all of them. I ultimately was honored by their choice of me as being a chief of the Civil Division. And in that, we handled certain cases under the Civil Rights Acts that had been passed at that time, opening up neighborhoods and places where people could work. We also dealt with the wide-body jets coming into Metropolitan Airport and won that case under Cornelia Kennedy, one of the finest jurors that has ever served in the Eastern District. And I also had the honor of working with Damon Keith, one of my heroes. When I was president of the Federal Bar Association, we had a lot of criticism of individuals practicing in the trial bar at that time, and I went to him and suggested we have a new lawyer seminar. That new lawyer seminar took off because of Damon Keith's support and is now in every U.S. district in the United States.
You then went on to become the first court administrator for the Oakland County court system, and in that role, one of the things you did was led the effort to computerize the court.
I wasn't sure what a court administrator was when the Oakland Circuit with James Thorburn and Judge Beasley all approached me about becoming a court administrator. He says, that like a super clerk. I'm a trial attorney. Well, they said, we now need administrators. Judges can no longer control their own dockets. And the courts have grown so large with the number of cases coming in as a result of the civil rights movement, products liability, employment law, that the caseload is just simply overburdensome for the judges to continue administrating it. So we need an outside administrator. You've been an officer in the Army. You were a chief of the Civil Division of the United States Attorney's Office. We think you would be the one. Well, I know a little bit about the state courts at that time, but I learned very quickly. And I was told to computerize the court system. Well, I knew about as much about the computer as anyone would. I knew how to turn it on. And we had a great IT group in Oakland County at that time, and a young man by the name of Sid Vaidya, who had come over from India, had gone to Michigan Tech, and was there over at IT. And I told him on our first hearing, I said, Mr. Vaidya, you have been given the direction by our court to fully computerize this court and make it one of the first computerized court systems in the United States. By the way, once you've accomplished that task, I take all the credit. Sid and I laughed. We became good friends as a result of that. His son ultimately became one of my clerks and is now a fine attorney out in Livingston County. His other son is a doctor and his daughter is a nurse, and they played a big role in our lives. He went on to General Motors and on to become a executive vice president of EDS, and has done great work and certainly helped to computerize our court system.
We're talking to Judge Fred Mester. When we come back, we'll ask him how Governor Milliken changed his life. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Judge Fred Mester. Let's jump to 1982, Judge. Governor Milliken changes your life. What happened?
Well, I knew I was on the list for appointment as a Oakland Circuit Judge, and I just wasn't certain of the weight that my name may have on that list. And one afternoon, my wife and I were watching our daughter, Catherine, do a have our fifth grade class at Burton School in Huntington Woods, and we were enjoying their presentation and Kathy's participation in that. And overcomes running the principal of the school. He said, Mr. Mester, the governor's on the phone. He wants to talk to you. And I thought, well, here's Kathy going to come up on the next episode of the presentation that they're presenting. I said, well, can I call him right back? My wife gives me a little elbow on, you just lost yourself a judgeship. So we watched Kathy go through the presentation, enjoyed it with her fellow students who were just remarkable, the entire class. And if I can just mention, I'm glad I sat there at Hunter School because that daughter ultimately died in a terrible car accident. And I'm glad I made the choice that she was primary at that time. And then I went to the principal's office and I picked up the phone and called the executive assistant to the governor, Joyce Braithwaite. I said, Joyce, I'm sorry I couldn't take the phone call, but my daughter was just coming on in the show that the fifth grade was putting on. And she says, well, I'm sorry, the governor had to go to Grand Rapids. And I thought, oh boy, I have lost it. However, he wanted me to offer you an opportunity to become a part of the Sixth Judicial Circuit in Oakland County. Do you accept? And I think I said, can you give me a half a second? And, of course, I accepted it, and I've admired Governor Milliken before then. I admired him after that, and he and his family has been a good friend as well as the Braithwaites.
Judge, what did 26 years behind the bench teach you?
Well, it taught me that everyone that comes to the courtroom deserves a fair and just hearing. That the admonition that Socrates gave, that if you're going to be a judge, you got to hear courteously. Someone's got a story to tell, and each of them need to be able to tell their story in an open court for them to go away realizing that they were treated fairly. So you got to hear courteously, and you've got to answer the lawyer's questions wisely, and you got to consider everything that comes before you soberly and decide impartially. That's what Socrates said makes a great judge. Hopefully I followed that rule. And I would add the additional admonishment to be humble in your presentation in an open courtroom, because our courts introduce to the individual in the streets, whether he's a party to a lawsuit or he's a juror or just a visitor to the court, the essence of this great country, a country of law, not of men. And that's what our founding fathers taught. And I think it behooves each of us who play the role of a judge in all of our courts, whether state or federal or local, as well as the staffs of our individual courts, to demonstrate that admonishment of Socrates to hear courteously, answer wisely, consider soberly, and decide impartially with a lot of humility.
Speaking of humility, the power of a judge is enormous. You're there for life, in many cases, yet it never went to your head. How did you stay humble?
Well, I suspect that you recognize that the problems that come before you in that open court are horrendous problems, and they are presented to you in a way in which you sometimes recognize your limitations and be able to come up with the right answer. And I think it's imperative that you demonstrate both to the attorneys as well as to the respective parties that you consider the questions they're presenting with a great deal of humility, a great deal of attempt to understand fully both sides' positions on the issues in the making decision. I hope I have served in the manner which you just described. You certainly hope on every case, no matter whether it's a simple question of somebody's property, or it is a murder case, or even in the critical question of divorce and family matters that may come before the court. They're all important. It's imperative that a person that has the honor to wear the black robe as I did recognize that each person comes to that courtroom has to be seen with dignity.
26 years, a judge. thousands of cases, and in October of 1996, you're on the cover of Guidepost Magazines, the Norman Vincent Peale monthly, fabulous, uplifting magazine. And the title was Judge Fred Mester - A Story About Justice and a Boy Who Did the Right Thing. Tell us about that article.
Well, I'd like to mention his name. His name is Kenneth Briggs. And today, Kenneth Briggs is helping others in they're going through their drug and alcohol abuse to themselves and serving the community greatly. He and his wife are both doing that. I received a number of cases in regards to an incident that occurred in Pontiac. A young lady of 12 years of age was in Children's Village, and she was encouraged by an older girl to leave Children's Village and go into the city of Pontiac and have some fun. They ran into Kenneth's brother. And though Kenneth's brother was 23 years of age at that time, they thought he was about their same age, and he invited them over to his house. The older girl did not go, but the younger girl, whose name was Mary Ann at that time, did go. Kenneth's brother invited, I think it was five or six of his friends over, and they proceeded to sexually and physically assault her over the next several hours. Kenneth walked in, and these older men, all of them in their 20s, said, "Kenneth, come on, we're going to make a man out of you." Kenneth says, "No, what you're doing is wrong." Now, this is a 14-year-old who no longer had his parents. They both had died by the time he was 10, and he and his brother were living from house to house, made a decision at that moment that you're doing wrong, and ran out of the house, got two young girls from the neighborhood, and they helped to rescue Marianne, take her to the hospital, and then proceeded to go to the police and report on these individuals that had taken almost a life in Marianne. He ultimately testified at every court. The last time he testified before me, I had a meeting with the prosecutor, the investigator, and defense counsel afterward just to try to understand how the system went and whether we all did the right thing. I often learned from lawyers and from individuals who testify in my court how to conduct myself in the best way possible. And I asked him, I said, "Kenneth looked drugged and kind of tired today and looked like he had had a terrible night." And she says, "Well, Judge, after the word went out that he was testifying against these young men, a contract was issued on his life. We needed to get him out of Pontiac. We got him into an apartment. The apartment burned last night, and the only thing he has left in his life is what you see him wearing in the courtroom today. We need to get him out of this area so he can live comfortably and get his education done." Well, we got people contributing from all over. Custodians, secretaries, homemakers, lawyers, doctors, the athletic director of Rochester Hills at the time, and a whole group of people. One was a lawyer who came and said, "I have a cousin who is in Canada and teaches at a school. She's a spinster, and she'd like to see if Kenneth would like to come live with her, and she get him into the school and help him through his school years." And she did that. And ultimately, he asked to return to Pontiac and go to Oakland University, great university. And he, after we checked out, made sure that he could stay there comfortably. And the police said, "As long as he stays on Oakland campus, that'll be fine." We brought him back. We got him a job with Detroit Lions. My clerk came in and says, "Judge, there's a call from a Harpo Productions in Chicago." And I said, "Harpo? Harpo Marx?" I didn't know that the Harpo Production was a particular production company for a special individual at that time. But I picked up the phone, and it was the producer, and she indicated that Oprah Winfrey had read the story of Kenneth Briggs and would like to invite Kenneth, Marianne, and me to Chicago to the show. And I said, "Well, before we go, let me check out to see whether this is a good thing for both of them, because both of them have been through a lot of things that most people aren't going through, and I needed to find out whether this is good for them or bad for them." And finally, everyone came to me and said, "This can be nothing but a positive event for them." So we all went to Chicago. Kenneth was in a separate hotel, Marianne in a different hotel, Oprah brought them on the stage, and they met for the first time since the tragic controversy and the trials. And Oprah made it a great expression, showing kids throughout that week who made a difference.
We're talking to Judge Fred Mester, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crisula, and we're with a modern-day Don Quixote, Judge Fred Mester, who I now quote, "We have created a penal system that is a failure." And Judge, you tell us that the recidivism rate within 3 years is 48%, within 5 years is 78%. You're involved in a number of causes like Don Quixote, one of which is the Wolverine Campus Project. Tell us about that project.
Well, the Wolverine Campus Project was thought up several years ago by Ralph Kinney, George Ward, former deputy chief of the prosecutor's office in Wayne County, and Carl Malinga, who's a former prosecutor from Macomb County and now a judge in Macomb County. And they brought in a number of people to look at our penal system, the way we imprison people, along with individuals who had special skills to help to bring to an educational environment other than a penal environment. And the theory was that the problem with our penal system is that we take 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, we put them in prison, and we put them in prison with skilled prisoners, people who've been there and done that. For example, if you're a new prisoner, Mr. Quixula, and I'm an old prisoner, I've been around for a long time, and you come in, we sit at the lunch table, I said, "Mr. Quixula," I'll probably call you Jack back then, "Jack, they tell me that you went ahead and robbed a house that had a car sitting in its driveway. Don't you know if a car's in the driveway, that means somebody's at home?" And that's kind of a silly expression of the kind of communication that happens in a prison, but it's an example of they learn how to be a master in crime when we send them to prison. They are in a place with bars on the windows, where there are people walking around with a pistol and a club, and they eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Their bunk mate is another criminal, often more experienced than they, and they learn how to be a more skillful criminal. When they leave prison, they have rarely a skill that can be adapted in the community, so it's very difficult for them to have a job. And the second problem is that they have a tag onto their life called a felony. And so if an employer is interviewing two individuals, and one of them may even be less talented than the criminal, but the criminal has on his, or the past offender, has on his resume, "I'm a prior felon," they're going to take the less qualified individual who does not have the felony. So they're set with many hurdles. And the other hurdle is the fact that when you leave your prison or your jail, you're required by statute to return to the same zip code from where you came. So you're returning to all those influences that put you on the road to criminality in the first place. So the hope of you being able to rise yourself out of that condition is almost a failure from day one.
Wolverine Campus Project. Another quote. "You believe that we should have dignity from birth to death. And God blessed you and introduced you to a lady named Lynn decades ago. And you've been partners for 55 years. And Judge, 2.5 years ago, Lynn had a stroke. 5 hospitals, 7 nursing homes later, last 6 months in hospice. And you visit her every day, you spend time with her, and she's got dementia. And you've written a white paper, A Conversation About the Impending Crisis, Dementia and the Boomer Generation. Tell us about that white paper.
As Lynn went through this very difficult time and I saw her losing the reality that was facing us all every day, I began to see a lot of other people in the same condition, either in the 5 hospitals we've been in or the 7 nursing homes or twice at home when she broke her hip and broke her shoulder, and realized that there was a coming crisis that we were about to embark on. My generation is about a third of what the boomer generation is. The boomer generation is from 75 to 90 million people. And they're coming of age now. They're getting into the 65-plus bracket. And that's where they have their strokes. And that's where you begin to encounter dementia. And it seemed to me that we needed to begin to address the issues and confront the problems that are going to be faced by the boomer generation. We now have across the country about 15,000 nursing homes. That's going to be quadrupled, if not much higher than that. In the state of Michigan, we have 2 million people over the age of 60. 182,000 who are between the ages of 85 and 90, where dementia really takes over and takes charge. We have 1,700 people over 100 years of age. And by 2030, one quarter of the residents, not only in this state, but throughout the country, will be over the age of 60. So we're going to have to deal with these individuals. And rather than have them sit in a nursing home that ultimately becomes a warehouse for humans, we need to have a conversation on how we can try to attack dementia and help these individuals to live in dignity from birth to death. Dementia is a horrible situation. I go into the nursing home every day and I see individuals who are Lynn's fellow patients looking at the wall or looking down at the floor. And I know something's going through their minds. I'm very limited in understanding what it is. But there are weeks and months and years that they're sitting there. We as a civilization cannot accept this as a condition for people as they end their lives. The boomer generation is going to live a lot longer than my generation, and they're going to be beset by a far greater number of people with dementia. There's more money spent on cancer and heart, which is a correct thing to put our attention to, but there's more money expended privately by families and by others with people who have dementia and have strokes, simply because a longer term in which these people suffer from these particular illnesses. And having talked to a number of doctors and people in the field, we know very little. We have a lot of medication we throw at these individuals, but I sense the medication is more to keep them quiet, keep them occupied to the common denominator in each one of these nursing homes or hospitals, rather than we have a real cure.
We're talking to Judge Fred Mester, one of the greatest men we have in this community. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Judge Fred Mester, board member of the Wolverine Campus Project. And in 2011, he was inducted into the Journalism Hall of Fame at Central Michigan University. Judge, another one of your causes, of your many causes, is Neighborhoods plus Returning Veterans equal Neighborhood University.
Well, as a veteran, I take a great deal of interest in the fact that we have about 50,000 veterans returning to this area in the next 18 months. There's a number of organizations and individuals that are doing great things right now. For example, the Oakland County Bar Association, Michael Schloff and other members of that bar are really stepping up. There's an individual who was on the line at Ford Motor Company, who Barbara Grasso, who won the Governor's Award last year, who singularly had no one involved in the military, but did have friends and wanted to show she could participate as a citizen. So we have citizens rising up. And one thing that we have noticed in Detroit, that Detroit is coming back along Woodward Avenue. What we need to make sure is that it comes back in its neighborhoods as well. The Quicken Loans and the Elledges and the Fords have done a remarkable job in creating a very lively community all along Woodward. We need to get into the neighborhoods. And one thing I thought of is opening up our arms to incoming veterans and getting them to where they can begin to focus on community and their new life they're going to have is to open up the neighborhoods. Take the city of Detroit and the city of Pontiac, make a calculus of four block areas, and take two homes in those areas to be constructed by, ready to build, or Habitat for Humanity, private citizens who come in, and invite those veterans to come and purchase those homes at a relatively reasonable cost, where we say we're opening up ourselves to you veterans, giving you an opportunity to live in your own home now. In addition to that, take a third home and do the same thing with it, but have AmeriCorps volunteers, individuals from colleges and universities throughout the country, who commit themselves to 2 years of a commitment to the citizens of the United States, very similar to the Peace Corps, and have them set up in that home a place where you can tutor, you can mentor, you can have an employment agency, you can have the county medical section in there, and as well as law enforcement to visit periodically so that the community, the neighborhood, this four-block area, can sense that they don't have to go downtown to get this service of an employment agency or medicine or education. They can do it right across the street. And that's what the neighborhood university will be. Be encompassing all those good services that we have in the county or in the city, but they're just too far from the neighborhood. And have the service people working with these AmeriCorps people, because they bring into that community stability. They bring in an intact family. They bring in children who have a sense of discipline, great role models, and great way in which you can work with your neighbors in becoming a better neighborhood.
Another one of your causes you're involved with is the Special Olympics. Lois Arnold was a guest. She runs the Michigan Special Olympics, fabulous lady. In spending time with these Special Olympians, Judge, what have they taught you?
Well, they have taught me that there's dignity within our Special Olympians, that they can teach each one of us to have that same dignity. They have a love for their fellow competitor, that even though they are winning the race, if they see a fellow competitor fall, they'll reach down and help that individual. That's something that I think a lot of us can learn, how we have to help our fellow human being in becoming dignified and becoming a part of the community. We're all part of one community, and these Special Olympians surely are. And what Lois and all the other administrators of the Special Olympians have done, have created a venue by which we can see these very special young people give of their love, their compassion, their caring for others, that we can learn from them to care for each other as well.
Edward Hoke was the 17th governor of Kansas, and he lived from 1849 to 1925. And he's the man that came up with the famous Serenity Prayer. There's so much good in the worst of us, and so much bad in the best of us, that it hardly behooves any of us to criticize the rest of us. And Judge, that's how you live. Talk about that Serenity Prayer.
Well, I think it speaks to each of us as to how we should conduct our lives. I think it's very easy to get angry with others, to get yourself to feel more comfortable when you can look down upon others or express an anger towards someone else. But I think it limits us when we do that. We limit who we can become when we don't give dignity to the individual, whether we agree with them or not. And I think that it's imperative that each day where we have that interest in finding individuals who we may be angry at, may be jealous of, may be envious of, that we step back and we say a little prayer about forgiveness. In both the 23rd Psalm of the Old Testament and the Lord's Prayer, they speak about forgiveness and to put a table around you of those people who you may perceive as your enemies. And I think it's imperative upon all of us to recognize that we are all of one people and we're all children of God.
As our time winds down together this evening, what advice would you give, Judge Mester, to our young listeners?
Well, I think to do best you can in whatever you're engaged in, to participate in your school, in your classroom, in your athletic contests, and to look around for others who may not be able to have the talent that you may have, not scholarship that you may have, and show a friendship for them as well. It will help you in the long run. And I would use that cell phone as little as possible and look people in the eye and talk to them, because that's what you're going to be doing the rest of your life. And I think it's a sense of caring, a sense of communication, a sense of recognizing you're part of a great country, an exceptional country, and learn about that. Learn about our forefathers. Learn about all those who fought in our many wars and those who have fought to create a better life for all of us, regardless of race, creed, or color. Because that's what has made this country an exceptional country and a light for the rest of the world.
As you stated earlier, Judge Mester, Socrates said there's four traits to a great judge. Hear courteously, answer wisely, consider soberly, decide impartially. He was talking about you. Thanks for all you've done and all you continue to do.
Thank
God
you.
Bless.
Thank you.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.